Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, Chair of the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Vice Chair of the Club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Dr. Jane Hightower got her undergraduate education at Chico State with a major in biology and a minor in chemistry. She graduated from the University of Illinois at Chicago Medical School in 1988 and did a residency at St. Mary's Hospital and Medical Center in San Francisco. In 2000, she began to notice symptoms of mercury poisoning among her affluent Pacific Heights patients and traced the source of mercury to the larger ocean predator fish. Her findings led to a study published in the November 1st, 2002 issue of Environmental Health Perspectives, a journal from the National Institute of Environmental Health Services. Today, she's a doctor of internal medicine at the California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco and lives in the Bay Area. She recently published the book, Diagnosis Mercury, Money, Politics, and Poison. Jane?
Thank you very much for coming. And first of all, this has been a real adventure. And I'm glad to see a few of my patients here in the audience. Some were actually study patients. I'm glad to see they're doing well. But the first thing that I'd like to cover is people have generally asked me, how did I possibly get into the mercury issue? And essentially, it was discovered by pure serendipity. Dr. Kathy Fields, a dermatologist colleague of mine, and she was traveling through Idaho and heard on the radio, public radio, that people were losing their hair eating fish out of a lake. And Idaho has a lot of problems with mercury in their lakes. So being a dermatologist, many times they can't find out what causes hair loss. So she thought, well, I'm going to test it on somebody. So in walks one of my patients who I couldn't find out what was wrong with her. And I was seeing a lot of patients at the time. Being a diagnostician, internal medicine physician, I had a lot of people coming to me with various and sundry symptoms with a big, large workup worth thousands of dollars, and no one can figure out why they had fatigue and headaches, stomach upset, troubles thinking, insomnia, muscle and body aches. So what we found out is this patient had high mercury levels, but the problem was we didn't know how to read the numbers. Nobody did. And it's really kind of interesting. It became a nightmare. The laboratory told us normal is less than 13 at the end of a work week. Well, I didn't know anybody that ate fish for a living, so I thought, well, that didn't seem right. And what the problem was is that no one corrected present laboratory reporting. It still relies on inorganic poisoning that you see in occupational. So no one really had in the lab this idea that you can get organic poisoning for the general public. Cecil's textbook of medicine, 1996, said normal is less than 50. They hardly had any information. EPA, I read on the internet, and later in NRC, the National Research Council, said less than 5. The FDA was undeclared, still undeclared to this day, and I wondered why. It was rumored to be less than 200 was normal. The three important facts, though, you need to know is that when we're dealing with mercury, the human reference dose is the dose that the EPA and others think is a dose that is helpful, or actually say safe. So you have less than that dose. Then there's the amount and humans considered safe. So you have those two levels. And the third is the action level. And that's the level in fish of mercury that is considered safe. And it's this action level that I was the most concerned about, because now we call it the no action level. And I'll tell you how we got there. I discovered that this action level was derived in a court of law. it used bad data. It's not enforced. This has allowed the consumers, the high-end consumer, to be at risk for mercury toxicity. And they did this so that they can, the fishing industry can sell fish to the masses without the notion that mercury causes harm. So here we have the mercury pathway for all those who don't realize how it gets there. You have mercury in the water and air. The bacteria take it up, put the methyl on it. Plankton take it up. Small fish are taking up the plankton, and so on. You get the big fish here, and then I don't know what he's cooking on that grill, but it's awfully big, and it probably has a lot of mercury in it. The fishing industry mantra. Essentially, they say there has never been a case of mercury poisoning from normal consumption of ocean-going fish in this country. Boy, there's a lot of legalese in that. They say normal. And the statutes, what I discovered, do not protect anyone that is not with normal consumption. If you eat more than 2 times a week fish, you're not normal. And what we discovered is that the high-end consumers who are coastal, Asians and Pacific Islanders, Native Americans, my pescatarians, you're not normal. So they're not going to really look at your affairs and how your health is because you're not protected by Proposition 65 or any other statute. The other thing is that they say no one eats enough fish for mercury to be of concern, and that's not true. Some of the numbers that we are getting are higher than many populations around the world that are being currently studied for the effects of methylmercury. They also do not take into account that cardiovascular disease increases with mercury exposure, infertility, long-term neuropsychiatric effects, and autoimmune disease induction. So what did the EPA say? I think it's really important for you to know the big controversy is that when the USDA gave up fish to the FDA, it's caused a little bit of a problem. Right now, the FDA is in charge of commercial fish, but the EPA is in charge of non-commercial fish. So you can have a warning for sea bass from the EPA and go to the grocery store and buy it without a warning from the FDA. So the EPA in their mercury study report to Congress said, consumers not limited by income that consume a large portion of their dietary protein from fish, especially if they choose large predators such as swordfish, sea bass, etc., would be at risk for exposure to mercury. So what are we hearing? You look at the fine print, it says fresh island fish, live longer, eat fish. So there's a lot of claims to health from fish. But fish isn't the only game of town when it comes to getting your omega-3 fatty acids. Remember that. There's other sources, nuts and seeds, flax, the grass-fed beef, the vegetarian-fed hens and their eggs, etc. Here's what we're doing. And my goodness, we're certainly doing a lot of it. This is pictures that were taken. In my book, I talk about getting kicked out of Whole Foods for taking pictures with EPA person Kate Mahaffey. And it really was the store that I shop at. But my husband came in later, and him being so tall, he just said, I'm going to take a picture. And they just let him do it. So, well, you know, the FDA isn't seeing pink elephants. Yop, we are here, we are here, we are here, we are here. And I really do identify with Dr. Seuss's Horton Hears a Who. So the FDA and I think the fishing industry are really trying to burn my dust speck. But we really do have a population at risk. And one of the things I want to talk about is the most noted recent mercury sources. Of course, coal-burning power plants, really important. China is polluting the world, okay? We get China's plume, California does. So that's very much of concern. Mining, of course, waste incinerators, hospital crematoria, cement factories, and that came into play just recently in the Bay Area, thimerosal, which has ethyl mercury, chemical plants, fungicides, chloralkali plants. There's still a number of, you know, a few chloralkali plants that lose mercury directly into the water. Switches, fluorescent lights, gauges, shipwrecks, all right? Spanish World War II. The one wreck that I presented in my book, thanks to the treasure divers that called me. I had interesting people calling me all over the world. And the treasure divers were fascinating. Mel Fisher's lawyer, I talked to him. Roy Roosh, some of the professors that are involved in treasure diving. The largest shipwreck of mercury that we know about was the 1724 shipwreck that brought down two ships, and together they had 400 tons of quicksilver. It is currently sitting on the Marl off the coast of Dominican Republic, and no one has taken it up yet. World War II, all the mercury fulminate. Aeronautics industry also used mercury. Submarines don't breach their hulls as fast as other ships, by the way. So there's a lot of submarines that use mercury as ballast, and they're probably going to breach over the next 100 years. Volcanoes, earthquakes, geothermal vents, these things are also a source of mercury. Latex paint until 1991. Amalgams for teeth, mercurochrome. It wasn't until 1998 that the over-the-counter medications for mercurials were finally removed because the FDA said, look, you're grandfathered in, you never were proven safe, effective, so we're going to make you all new drugs. So not one company came forward to prove safety and efficacy, so they're just removed. The infectious disease docs always say that mercurochrome just served as a good paint to let their technicians know where not to touch the wound. So while we're embracing our fish, there's a little sea bass there, we have to know about mercury dosing, and I just want to let you know that it cannot be cooked out of the fish. Mercury is on average 95% absorbed when consumed. It is taken up by all tissues 1 to 2 days after a single dose. PCBs and other pollutants can be reduced by grilling, but don't eat the skin or the fat. And the half-life in blood is about 2 months. For the average person, and children probably longer, about 90 days. And one thing you have to note is that every organ has a different half-life. Fish consumption advisories. Now remember, non-commercial means EPA. And there's a total of 39 chemicals, but most advisories involve 5 contaminants as far as the advisories. And the top 5 are mercury, polychlorinated biphenyls, or the PCBs, dioxins, DDT, and chlordane. In 2001, that was one of the later websites I can find, there was over 2,600 advisories alone in that year. Right now, we have over 79,000 lakes under advisory, over 485,000 river miles, all of the Great Lakes and connecting waters, Lake Champlain, Chesapeake Bay watershed, 20 national estuaries, and many others. And this is the EPA. Yet, if you look at some of the mercury advisories for these lakes, again, you can walk into the grocery store and through FDA buy mercury-laden fish, and there's no warning. So the FDA advisory, and I always get a kick out of this. This is just recently taken off their website, and I marked a few things in red. And the FDA says, by following these 3 recommendations for selecting and eating fish or shellfish, women and young children will receive the benefit of eating fish and shellfish and be confident that they have reduced their exposure to the harmful effects of mercury. It doesn't say you're going to reduce actually the toxicity. It doesn't say it's going to protect you 100%. It just means that you're going to reduce your exposure. They say not to eat shark, swordfish, king mackerel, tilefish because they contain high levels of mercury. But remember, the FDA has what they call is a targeted and nuanced approach that says very little to a select few. This advisory is aimed at women of childbearing age, pregnant women, nursing mothers, and young children. They are not addressing the other issues as far as the general public when they should, but the National Academy of Sciences did. They also say 5 of the most commonly eaten fish that are low in mercury are shrimp, canned light tuna, salmon, pollock, and catfish. But remember, for canned light tuna, there's a roulette game going, because on canned light, even though most of the time it's lower in mercury, the FDA allows the tuna canners to actually put in their surplus bluefin, ahi, and yellowfin, which can be over 1 part per million in the can. So you have to be very careful. So I don't have pregnant women consuming that. Another commonly eaten fish, albacore tuna, has more mercury than canned light. It actually has at least 3 times more. So when choosing your 2 meals of fish and shellfish, you may eat up to 6 ounces of albacore tuna per week. This was so controversial of a statement, by the way, that it caused some people to actually walk out of the FDA advisory committee, because the FDA, in saying this, means that they're allowing more mercury consumption for a pregnant woman than many other regulatory agencies, including the EPA and around the world. But the tuna industry is a very strong lobbyist in this issue. And I think the last one is, says it all. They say, check local advisories about the safety of fish caught by family and friends in your local lakes, rivers, and coastal areas. If no advice is available, eat up to 6 ounces. Now, wait a minute. If you don't have any local advice and you're pregnant, don't eat it. Okay? I don't know why the FDA would say, if you don't know anything, it's okay. And so I think that's not the best health message. So what did I do to cause such a stir? Well, I knew that there was a lot of confusion. And what I realized is that no one had ever looked at a population in the United States to look at mercury levels who are high-end consumers. The people in my practice, they did not like fishy flavor. They wanted something that didn't fall through the slats on the grill. They didn't like bones in the fish, and they weren't deterred by the price. So they, in essence, ate high mercury fish. So what did my survey show? Essentially, the mean mercury level was 14 for the study population, higher than even the average of NHANES, the CDC's report. But remember, the CDC isn't going to have your downtown executive on a CDC report. The people that get missed on NHANES oftentimes are the affluent and the very poor. So the average number of meals actually was about 18 per month, but the range was 3.5 to 50 per month. One patient consumed 35 meals per month, but was mostly wild salmon, a low mercury fish. So their mercury was only 6. But 12 patients were within the FDA's current recommendations and only ate 2 meals a week, and they still were over the mark or where they want them to be. And any time in a woman's pregnancy, it is said that her mercury goes to 14 or 15, she does stand a chance of knocking IQ points off her child. The individual with the highest level was eating swordfish, essentially 14 meals a month, and her level was 89. I think the record right now for blood is in the hundreds. I've had one man that had a hair level of 44, and if you multiply that times 4, that gives you an average blood level, and he wasn't feeling very well either. And the guy that ate 50 meals a month was mostly canned light tuna, some sushi, and salmon. So he's a large man, and his mercury was 15. So I saw all these people with symptoms, all right? And a lot of these symptoms can be in an average person that comes to the internal medicine practice. So how can you tell that these are from mercury? And physicians, a lot of times when we're diagnosing, we have a differential diagnosis. All we can say is, well, it's consistent with a diagnosis. But my goodness, if you're eating poison and it's elevated in your blood and you're not feeling well, stop eating poison and see if you feel better. It's not real difficult of a diagnosis. So what did I do? I told them to stop the unthinkable. Oh my goodness, Dr. Hightower, you told people to stop eating fish? You bet. I didn't know if they're allergic to it. There are people with long lives who don't eat fish because they're allergic to it. So what's the big deal? Well, because fish is good for you. Well, what's part that's good for you? The omega-3s? I can get them in other places. So the argument continues. And so when my patients stopped, this is out of my paper, their mercury levels went down. And when they re-challenged themselves, it would go back up again and then later come back down when they stopped. So here's our turtle people. So they get out there, and they're ranting and raving. They're complaining about, look, you know, the long lining is destroying the turtles. Oceana's in it. People are complaining they're not feeling well. And then here comes the pushback. And it's not just the industry. It's whole entire states. This is taken by a pediatrician friend of mine, John Bolton, who was in New England at the time in the airport. And this says, strengthen the New England economy, and shows us a woman with a nice build with a weight in one hand and fish in the other. It says, and your body, eat seafood. So where do we look for people who have had experience in this? Well, there's multiple countries. Canadians, I talk about the first mercury scare. The only reason why I knew that there was a mercury scare in 1970 was that The industry said, oh, that Dr. Hightower, she's responsible for the second mercury scare. I thought, wow, there is a first. So I thought, decided, well, let's look it up. And in my book, I discuss this. But Japan also had a terrible poisoning. And it was in Niigata and Minamata Bay when the Chiso Company and other and Showa Denko plants directly dumped methylmercury into the bay and poisoned the people. It was terrible. And I discuss that in my book. And so a lot of the toxicity that came out of that was out of a lawsuit. And so these nonspecific symptoms can be overstated by people looking for a lawsuit, and they can also be understated by people not wanting to find anything. So it's very difficult unless you have a proper study to look at this. And so they showed that people on the what they call lesser minamana, or lesser symptoms, they had these nonspecific symptoms, a lot of what I was seeing. And so I thought, well, wow, maybe this has been reported before. It has to have been reported before. We can't be the first group of people that have been doing this kind of fish and having effects. So here's actually a picture taken by my friend Michael Bender of Mercury Policy, and this was at the Almaden Mine. This is not water. This is actually quicksilver. Important fact. So what kind of study do you need? Well, there has never been a blinded, placebo-controlled study giving humans methylmercury to discern the entire spectrum at adverse effects ever published. Now, if I were to try to get that kind of study done, I'm sure the Institutional Review Board would have a little problem with that. I'm sure it'd be difficult to get that passed because it's a known toxicant, right? But if you go to the grocery store, you can have high mercury levels in the fish, and you can eat it as much as you want, and there's no consent form ever signed. So there's something wrong with that. So the effects in children. Now, there's a couple of major studies that have been done in children. One is the Faro studies, study done in Denmark, and they showed that these low-end exposures and the amount of exposure that we in the Bay Area are getting, you can have problems with language and attention, memory, visual-spatial disorder, fine motor problems. The children are slower to react to auditory stimuli. Their blood pressure is more or less regulated. And there's tremendous variability in these children. One of the things we notice is that there is a condition called acridinia or pink disease. All right? Now, this is described in the 1800s, but it wasn't until the 1940s that they figured out it was all those mercurial teething powders and deworming agents and things we were giving the children that caused this. And these children, some of them in Wales alone, over 500 kids died. Now, we could never figure out why some kids with the same exposure walked away. So we still have not solved the riddle. And it's the same thing with the Hatters. I have the Hatters public health documents. You know, Kate Mahaffey at US EPA gave me the copies of those documents when they came in and looked at the Hatters for Danbury shakes and the Mad Hatter disease. Remember, there was mercury put in the hatting industry. And in my book, I describe that. And essentially, this occupational disaster was terrible. You had people all over the place walking around in Danbury, Connecticut, that had a problem. But they hid this a lot of times, and the workers themselves, because they didn't want to be blacklisted. So it went on for a long time, and it was the New Jersey Medical Society first described this in 1860, but it wasn't until 1941 that they finally removed mercury from the hatting industry. And now in those areas of Connecticut, it's the EPA Superfund site because there's so much pollution. So what's the difficulty? Well, you know, when you're dealing with, or I should go back. I want to say one thing about the Seychelles study as the counter to this. The Seychelles study, it's a sovereign nation in the Indian Ocean, and they're the counter study that says, we didn't see anything. We don't have any effects at those levels. And so I investigated that. And what I discovered was that the Seychelles study was partly funded by the fishing industry and the power companies, the power plant lobby, EPRI. And as you know, coal-fired power plants are a big cause of mercury poisoning in our oceans and streams. But the main thing is that it's interesting that they use fishing industry employees and their relatives as study subjects. The other thing is that the Seychelles government runs the second largest tuna cannery in the world, and they own 40% of it. And their government workers in the small nation, where most of their GNP is from tuna cannery, were involved in telling us what people, how mercury affected their population. So I would say the conflicts of interest are there, and all we know is that, you know, we better just sort of put that in the back of our head and say, which study would you rather rely upon? So the difficulty with correlations, well, when you're eating fish, it can be all different doses. You don't know when the person got the dose. So it's very difficult when you test someone 1 week, it might be a higher level, and the next week it might be a little lower. So it's very difficult unless you know the actual dose the person had. Now, as Philippe Grandjean explains to me, that you can get, in group studies, you get this departure from the norm, but you can't ever really single out the most sensitive individual. So that's, that study has never been done, and that's where you need more of the individuals to do that. So the kinetic differences between individuals is astounding how different it is. The other thing is the overt clinical signs are much easier to diagnose. I mean, if someone's, then this subjective symptom, I can tell pretty much if someone has a coma, but I can't tell really if they have a headache. That's very difficult. So it's a real problem. And using rat studies is very difficult because rats can't tell you if they have a headache. So when did the wheels fall off the cart? Well, in 1977, the FDA sued Anderson Seafoods Incorporated. And it was fascinating that that was a seafood proprietor that sold swordfish. And they said, you know, hey, our seafood does not harm anybody, and we're going to prove it to you. And they were conducting studies in American Samoa that has the number one tuna cannery in the world. And they used cannery workers to say, we don't have a problem with this product. It's safe. And they also used Peruvian fishermen who were running the largest swordfish industry in the world. That was who they used to say mercury causes no harm. Now, it's really interesting that we had poisonings that came up, and one was Niigata, of course, but they only had two patients from Niigata. They didn't really know the actual blood levels of mercury. But an interesting thing happened in Iraq in 1971, where a large amount of grain was purchased from the United States, and it had a mercury fungicide on it. It arrived in Basra on time, but it was delayed getting to the people. The warnings were in Spanish and English for the farmers, and it said, don't eat, you're supposed to plant it. So the guys, knowing that this grain was coming, and this was under Saddam Hussein's regime, he was vice president in charge of all the ministries at the time, the farmers thought, well, if the market's going to be flooded, we better sell off the grain that we have. So they didn't know it was going to be delayed. Why it was delayed has never been investigated. And Iraq already had two previous poisonings in Iraq. So they knew that if they didn't warn the people, that they were going to eat it and they're going to die and or be permanently harmed. So what happened was that the grain got there late, and they didn't have the grain enough time to plant it because they gave it too late in the planting season. So they ate it instead. Thousands died. And I go over this in the book. The book will be the first book that ever put this poisoning using the scientific literature together with what we knew about the events that surrounded this terrible event in Iraq. Because there was a news blackout that was issued, very few reporters were ever allowed in to look at this. So it was very interesting. And whether this had malicious intent, I think I leave it to the reader, but it's something for the Iraqis to really look at. Because at the time, they were really trying to Arabize Kirkuk. So what happened? The fishing industry, they were really interested in jumping over there and finding out if mercury, which was in the fungicide, would affect the people. So who was involved with this type of investigation? That's what I wanted to know. Because what I saw was the judge in the Anderson trial said that the Iraqi data showed by preponderance of the evidence that the blood minimal clinical effect level for methylmercury was 400 micrograms per liter. My goodness, I think I'm going into a coma right now, because that's very high. So the judge, instead of keeping the action level at 0.5, he raised it to 1. He thought he was doing everybody a favor, because the fishing industry actually wanted 2. What happened with this? Because it was raised to 1, you know, on average, swordfish is 1. What that did was allowed swordfish to be on the market. If they would have kept it at 0.5, swordfish would have been taken off the market permanently. So, of course, there's always details, right? And as I say, that the Iraqi poisoning was fascinating, that it was under the Ba'ath Party. And as I looked at this investigation, with the fall of Saddam, we can get a little bit more information. And the Ba'ath Party government, Dr. Sadun al-Takridi, Saddam's personal physician, Dr. Farhan Bakr, Dow Chemical and the fishing industry sponsored American researchers and the WHO were the ones that looked at the data from Iraq. But who was in charge of the Iraqi data? I thought, well, you know, this is interesting. Saddam was kind of in charge even when he was vice president. And it was this guy right here. And it says in the scientific papers, all data was provided by Dr. Sadun al-Takridi. So I thought, well, let's find the whereabouts of him. And luckily, there's a couple of Iraqi physicians at CPMC Medical Center. So through them and through their relatives, we found out that Dr. Sadun al-Takridi, with the fall of Saddam, he was protected by Saddam. But as soon as Saddam fell, he came to the United States in 2003. And I interviewed him in 2004. And without provocation, he says, oh, I didn't give all the data to the WHO for political reasons. I'll write a book about it someday. And I wonder, has he any idea that we base the data that he didn't give and he did give on our standards for what we consider safe in our fish? So it's bad data. Now, Dow is important because they were responsible for the first mercury scare. It was Dow Chemical and their Sarnia plant in Canada that caused the first mercury scare. It went into the United States. People started testing mercury in the United States in our lakes and streams. Alabama was even declared a disaster area at the time. And all of a sudden, with the Anderson trial, everything sort of disappeared as far as mercury causes no harm because of the Iraqi data allowed the fishing industry to continue selling high mercury fish because they said it doesn't affect us. Of course, here's a picture of one of those sacks, and you can see that it is in Spanish. And by the way, the rye, I was given a report by Philippe Grandjean, which he had on file. I mean, this was, finding these documents was like finding rare baseball trading cards. It really was. There are some documents that are very difficult to find. And Philippe gave me a document that Amin Zaki, one of the Iraqi researchers, presented to the WHO. And that's the only place I can find where it said where the rye came from. And it was from California. So I knew that I would find my Bay Area people somewhere else. And there they were. They were in the 1977 trial. And it was Weight Watchers International. They advised 5 fish meals per week for their weight loss program. Their participants began presenting with nonspecific symptoms, some with overt symptoms of mercury toxicity. And some had blood mercury levels between 50 and 100 micrograms per liter, consuming swordfish and tuna. But what happened to this? Why didn't we know that? Because the man who discussed this, he was a lead researcher for the Iraqis, for the Canadians, for the United States, who was working for Dow Chemical also, and working for the fishing industry and the Canadian government. He was the FDA's, whoops, what happened here? We lost a connection. He was the FDA's chief, he was the FDA's chief witness. But somehow, he couldn't get to the trial. Both sides really kept changing the times on him. So he never made it to the trial. He had a post-trial deposition. The deposition was sealed by order of the court, never entered into evidence. And what he said was these mercury levels. And he said Weight Watchers came to the University of Rochester and presented their cases. But it was buried. But I got the deposition from the Georgia archives, and in my book, discuss what he said. And he said with the Iraqi data, what he saw in Iraq, and with the Weight Watchers International, in his deposition, this man said that he worried about swordfish ever being on the market again, buried in the Georgia archives. The judgment of the fishing industry sponsored researchers during that Anderson trial is unbelievable. And even when I quoted some of these things, even the copy editor wondered, did they really say that? Well, they did. Here's a quote from the lead neurologist for the study. He was a lead neurologist, University of Rochester, who was investigating the Iraqi children. And the judge had asked him, you know, what constituted minimal mercury effects? He even restated the question twice, as far as Dr. Marsh restated the question, so he knew it wasn't taken out of context. Here's his quote. Children who were determined, were mildly affected, were children looking normal, running around, behaving normally, and only with the most minimal retardation. They were a little slower to walk, perhaps a little slower to talk. They had increased frequency of seizures compared to the control group. Their height was slightly shorter. Their head circumference was slightly smaller. These were all very, very minimal effects, end quote. I think we need another opinion. If this man was a neurologist looking at children that I looked at, I certainly would go elsewhere. And I don't think anybody in this day and age, and talking to the neurologists, would agree that any of these constituted minimal effects. And even in the trial, one of his counterparts at the University of Rochester for the FDA said, you got to have a lot of damage before you get to that point. But still, the judge ruled in favor of the fishing industry. So here our warnings go up. And remember, this targeted, nuanced approach, our Proposition 65 warning only pertains to the pregnant women. Remember, people of the reproductive and teratogen, you know, cancer protection. The Prop 65 does not protect anybody who isn't pregnant or planning a pregnancy. Now, I thought, well, it's interesting because the Chinese literature continue to show that male infertility is increased because of increased mercury levels. Isn't the male sperm part of the reproductive system? And why aren't they protected under Proposition 65? I got to question that, and no one has an answer. But still, the Proposition 65 was an interesting thing that happened with our Attorney General, and I describe it fully in the book. And the tuna industry won, and the same kind of tactics used in Anderson trial were also used in Proposition 65. And they convinced the judge that mercury was predominantly natural. Okay, and it's very fascinating how they did that. And so the tactics are still working for the industry. So what happens with our mercury warnings? Well, you know, they're kind of in the grocery stores, hidden somewhere, sometimes behind the counter of the restaurants. And what did the good old Del Monte do? Well, they sent out in 2003 this notice. And you can see down here it says, accordingly, we request that you do not place any warnings in or around canned tuna and that you do not use any warning that reference canned tuna. And at the bottom it says, naturally, Starkist Seafood will completely defend and indemnify you for any inability or liability you may incur as a result of complying with this request. So that's the fight we're in. So here you go with the AHA, the American Heart Association. Well, they're doing a very controversial thing. Since 1995, they've gone into the food endorsement business. Very controversial, because they are the ones that are supposed to tell us what's healthful. And remember, they came up with the criteria, and the tuna industry is sort of involved in getting this going, because in 1995, there's a lot of issues in mercury at that time also. And the American Heart Association, they advised that other people, this is the one for other people. They said other people can eat 14 ounces a week of fish with mercury levels that average 0.5, or 7 ounces a week of fish that with mercury levels on average of 1. Now, it's really interesting because this goes back to the 1970s WHO requirements when they looked at Iraqi data, and it requires that it allows for the consumption of 200 micrograms of mercury per week. That's like 5 times more than the EPA advises. It is much more than many different agencies recommend. It goes against advice given by the US EPA, the National Academy of Sciences, the WHO, European Union, Canada, numerous state health agencies, and peer-reviewed articles that have been published over the years, last 10 years, to include American Heart Association journals. Because if we only slightly increase our mercury levels, what's been shown in several different studies is that you negate the good effects of omega-3 fatty acids. Mercury is not a requirement of the heart healthy label. And these companies pay money to get the label on their product. You pay exclusivity increase money, or for exclusivity, you pay extra money. And that's why when you go into the grocery store, why don't you see these heart healthy labels on, let's say, bumblebee wild salmon? 10 times less mercury, 3 times more omega-3s. That's because Starkist pays for exclusivity. So I knew I had to get the American Medical Association involved. And thanks to my colleague back there, Bill Andrick, you know, he pushed this through too, and yelling at the CMA on the floor, which I describe in the book. But we decided to take my letter I wrote to Dianne Feinstein and make a resolution to recognize methylmercury as a hazard in food. And we need to have more recognition on this issue because we're exposing ourselves at high level. So it was passed by the San Francisco Medical Society. It was passed by the CMA. But when the AMA got there, someone told the AMA that there is a new directive that mercury causes no harm. We don't know who said it. Usually thing is the AMA works above board. They wouldn't tell us who said it. But it forced this issue into the science of science department of the Medical Society, and it took a whole year before it was finally passed. But it is passed. So if you ever hear the fishing industry say, oh, that Dr. Hightower, no one's paying attention to her, her colleagues don't agree. Well, I got the whole AMA to agree. So think about that. So while I'm making the industry mad by being out there and getting all this publicity, the no-action mercury level continues. And this is really interesting because this was just recently sent to Sue Kwan of KPIX News from an FDA official. And the quote says, this is her official quote, the FDA says, I will speak about how the FDA defines an action level. The action level is a non-binding guidance that the FDA issues to establish a level of a contaminant that may be regarded as adulterated or illegal. The action level serves as guidance for the FDA, but does not commit the FDA to take any action. The FDA action level was issued in 1979 based on data available at the time. So they're not checking. They don't enforce it. They don't warn. So it's buyer beware market. So if you think that's bad, I went on healthytories.org and I found all kinds of interesting things. This is a great website. And this purple crayon and some of these sets, this was 222 micrograms of mercury per gram. The purple crayon on the mini set is 783 micrograms per gram of mercury. These are made in China, and they're sold in Long's drugstores and various places. The colored chalk is 423. Now, chalk aerosolizes. Kids rub these crayons on themselves when they draw. You may watch a kid draw. I mean, they got it all over their hands. If you think that's bad, these toys, it has a screen metal headphone. This has over 3,000 micrograms per gram in just the earphones that your little girl's going to put in their ears. We don't know how much absorbs. But I think it's fascinating. Are we going to see the Chinese workers, like mad as a hatter, putting these toys together? What happens to these workers that are working with the lead and the mercury? And lead and mercury are synergistic, because some of these toys had lead in them too. Any more ideas? Of course, everybody knows this one. These compact fluorescent light bulbs have mercury in them, about 4,000 micrograms per bulb on average. And there's no real method of recycling these things. That's the fascinating thing. So they're going to issue these things saying, well, you know, we actually use less coal to operate them. Well, if you have solar energy and you're not using coal, then how does that work? You're actually still digging up mercury and continuing with the pollution. So when I was putting this book together, I'm just scratching the surface with you, and the book is much more laid out, I think, better than what I can touch upon here. And when I started thinking about how am I going to organize this, all I saw was this. And I had to get it down on paper. And over here you got the NGOs whirling around. And you got the FDA, they're kind of, oh my goodness. I think Bill was the one back there that said you should whirl them off the page. But they're not quite communicating. You got the lawyers just chomping at the bit to get in there. You got Republicans and Democrats fighting and the Green Party, it's both of you. American Heart Association, they're not really saying anything other than eat fish and tuna. And the patients are in the middle. I have mercury in my what? And the doctors had no idea. It says, huh? There's mercury in fish? I didn't think we had to know mercury. Well, we do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Hightower. It's a very, very interesting, informative talk. And now it's open for questions from the audience. I'll pass this microphone around.
How does a person get rid of mercury? I had mercury silver fillings for 52 years, and I cannot eat fish, as I was telling you earlier.
Mm-hmm. One of the things we do know is that mercury can leave the body. And so it can leave it through sweat. It's in our saliva. It's in our tears. It's in breast milk. So a lot of my folks, I tell them to sweat it out. The mercury miners, for the inorganic exposure, inorganic comes out of the skin much easier than methyl mercury because the body has to kind of demethylate it, we think, to get it out of the skin. So sweating it out is one way, but it will come out in the feces. It doesn't come out in urine that much. Now, I don't have people take those chelators that remove mercury faster because it'll take the mercury and send it through the kidney all at once, and I don't think that's very safe. And those agents really have not met FDA approval for mercury toxicity, even though the alternative care doctors are giving it. And there was a death a couple of years ago of a five-year-old child from the chelators, and they are bone marrow suppressive. So I'd say let it run out on its own. I have not prescribed chelators. It will come out of the body. The problem is if the longer you expose yourselves to methylmercury, it becomes demethylated in the brain. And once it does that, it cannot pass the blood-brain barrier, and the half-life, they think, is in years. We don't know if it's inert or not. It's not known.
What's a good rule of thumb in terms of how much fish to eat if I am to continue eating fish?
Well, I generally do the calculations. I know GotMercury has their information up, and they're using the same kind of calculation of what I used. And it has to do with your weight. Your weight and the dose of the average levels of the mercury. But I always tell people the more fish you consume, the lower the mercury levels should be in the fish. So in Canada, they give a nice little grid. If you go in the Canadian Food Inspection Program, and they have a grid where if you eat mercury-laden fish, then you should lay off for a while and eat these other fish. And so they have it kind of laid out. So I wouldn't eat fish that's bigger than your plate with the exception of salmon. I'm not talking about the piece of fish. I'm talking about the whole fish. And the smaller the fish, the less mercury. Because you also have to worry about PCBs. And so I always tell people, rotate your poisons. Eat a variety of food, okay? Because everything you eat can have something that can harm you if eaten too much. By the way, do a spot check now and again and keep your blood mercury under 5.
How do you do a spot check?
You can ask your doctor to get a whole blood mercury level. The problem I'm having is with Quest. Quest is not doing the test properly. So you have to ask them, to titer the blood level to less than 5 micrograms per liter. And they still aren't doing it. I've met with Quest representatives. And so I've been telling people to send it everywhere else except Quest. But it's just do a whole blood mercury level for a spot check. And if you want to know sort of what you ate over the month, then you do a hair level, and you can. There's various labs that will test that. And since mercury is so tightly adherent to the sulfhydryl groups in the hair, it's one of the few metals that is very acceptable to test for laboratory, according to the EPA and the CDC and the FDA.
Are there any companies that do the lab test where you can just send it in the mail and it's not going to cost that much?
I'm not sure. I think there probably is. And there are, if you pay for the test yourself, and it's not at a very expensive test, you should be able to get it done. And it's an easy test. It's not expensive as far as a blood test. In fact, when I described this in the book, the test cost $5.46 when we first started. I think they had it sort of mislabeled because I hadn't looked at their charges when we first started. But it's on the same machine that a blood lead level is tested on. So it's pretty straightforward.
I was told by Baykeepers, the spokeswoman from there, that also that mercury is actually in the oil that comes into California and into Chevron, that they put it, they actually store it in mercury to keep it from not spoiling, and then Chevron takes the oil and they don't even know, because they haven't been monitoring how much they're putting back into the water of the mercury. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I know that mercury is used as a slimicide. It's been put in latex paint and, of course, the fungicide. And it was put in vaccines as an antibacterial antiseptic. But what I found out was it's not a very good antiseptic. And so I was always questioning why it was still even in vaccines. And actually, it's an adjuvant. It stimulates antibody formation. But if they were to say, oh, we're going to use it for an adjuvant now, they would have had to prove safety and efficacy, because their antisepsis idea was grandfathered in. So I'm not sure about the oil. I wouldn't be surprised. But, you know, we just discovered that much of the chloralkali industry that still use the mercury cell actually is pharmaceutical industry and the high fructose corn syrup industry. And so it does get in high fructose corn syrup to a small degree.
You might be familiar that the Monterey Bay Aquarium puts out a seafood watch guide that and one of their indicators is seafood that may be, you know, contaminated with mercury or other contaminants. Do you believe there's enough science out there to substantiate what they believe to be true in printing on the cards?
Yeah, it's been over a year since I've looked at those cards. And I know that what I wanted them to do is see if you can get PCBs, mercury, and endangered all on the same card. And hopefully they've done that. Yeah. Right, and I know that they were going to work on that, because I did lecture at the Cooking for Solutions, in, I think it was 2006. And so I think that, yeah, there's some science to say, because they can go out and test. And one of the guys at Analytical Microsystems, Mal Wittenberg's group of Safe Harbor, has a testing ability of testing every fish that comes in, and he presented this to the FDA, and the FDA refused to test the fish. They said, we're not a testing facility. Again, they're not looking at the action level. So Mal Wittenberg has tested fish all over the world, trying to get people to test the fish. And the argument is, well, what are you going to do with the dead ones? Where are you going to send it? We have to eat it. But that's not a valid argument. So some fish, I think, we probably shouldn't eat. I just really do think that if you are going to eat fish, it should be in small quantities. Like the Canadians, they allow for an action level of 0.5, and the fish that are over that, they put them in what's called a gourmet fish category, not to be eaten very often. And we don't do that. We just say, okay, one part per million, and they don't even enforce that. But really, the tuna industry and the swordfish industry, they shot themselves in the foot back in the 70s in the Anderson trial by coming up with these ideas that, you know, you can go up to 400 in the blood and that you can have an action level of 1. What that did was allow for more pollution. So they only have themselves to blame for that issue, because they're the ones that set that standard. They're researchers.
Yes, I was just curious about, as far as donors for blood and bone marrow, what, with all the conflicting data, how do they determine what are too high levels to give to someone with the obvious adverse effects they could have?
I've never heard of anybody testing mercury for the bone marrow donors. No. I've never heard it being tested. So, I mean, it's a good question, and I don't know if they do test for heavy metals. They might do a heavy metal. I don't know if they're testing. They might do a heavy metal like lead and some of those things. Because, you know, it's interesting. One of the transplant doctors in liver said that a lot of their liver transplant people also were taking gabaglobulin shots, which had a lot of thimerosal in it. And they had all kinds of various and sundry symptoms. And what they discovered is that, well, there's a lot of mercury in the gabaglobulin shots. And they were getting a lot of mercury because they're taking those very often. So they're trying to change. They change that.
Is this something you think is going to be happening in the future? They should start testing for this.
I'd have to ask the transplant services if they what's on their panel. There's certain things that they put on the panel, and they might do just a general heavy metal screen. So I don't know.
Mine is simple. It's crab season. Where does it where do crabs stand?
Well, you know, crab is great. The lowest of mercury crab is your Alaskan king crab. You could eat that till the cows came home. It's pretty pretty good. Our Dungeness crab is fairly low in mercury. And the blue crab might be a little bit more. You know, lobster, actually, the long-lived lobster can be over one part per million. You want to stick to the small lobster, by the way. Scallops are okay.
Dr. Hightower, when you started this in 1999, it seemed like you're the very only doctor in the whole world that knew anything about this. What sort of support do you have now amongst your fellow peers?
Well, the AMA.
Yes.
And a lot of people are recognizing this now. And I think one of the ways to convince people was when the physicians themselves came forward with their mercury levels. Boy, did that get a lot of play. And I can't tell you how many physicians in just my 2100 Webster building came to me in a panic. I've got some of those symptoms, and my mercury's really high. I would say that it was my East Coast Jewish physicians who were trying to eat kosher and eating albacore tuna every day in the doctor's dining room that had the highest levels. And so, you know, we're trying to bring awareness. And like I said, some of my colleagues had some of the highest levels.
You mentioned the connection between mercury poisoning and autoimmune disease. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah. What we've discovered is that, especially in Brazil, they've looked at mercury exposure from the gold mining, and they've looked at inorganic and organic. And we've also had rat studies. There's been many studies done now on autoimmune induction. Remember, mercury is an adjuvant. It actually stimulates antibodies, and it'll stimulate autoantibodies in those genetically susceptible. So when they stimulated rats, especially with mercury, only those that had the genetic propensity to form like an anti-nuclear antigen that you see in lupus, only those gave the ANA. So it's fascinating. That's probably why I see some people tolerate this so well and other people do not. And there's a lot of other reasons why some people tolerate it more. So thyroiditis is another one that's been looked at, that you get autoimmune thyroid antibodies too. And there's just a variety of autoantibodies that mercury's been known to stimulate. But we've never seen that it actually causes lupus. We've never gone forward to take it to the next step.
If our new president made you head of the National Science Foundation, what would be your top priorities for mercury research or other research?
Well, there's a lot of top priorities. I think we certainly need to do something about a lot of the toxicants that are coming in from other countries and a lot of the products that are getting into our food. I think we need to make our food safer. But as far as mercury goes, the EPA has a lot of rules on the books already that they're not enforcing. So I'd like for them at least enforce the rules they have as far as capping the coal-fired power plants, making sure that no one's polluting. And the food industry, we have to have adequate warning. I think that you've got to at least tell the people that this fish can have over a certain mercury level. And I think that we should go way down to, okay, what fish as a range have less than 0.3? What has over that? What has over 1? And just label it as such and see what the market will bear. But make sure that it's labeled for the consumer.
Well, in your slide, we saw that, avoid the fat and skin. So could you elaborate about fish oils that people take and why should we be actually avoiding the fat and skin?
Okay, good question. Because they're two different products. The PCBs are in the fat and chlordane and DDT and in the skin. So you can really reduce, if you get a fishing license, it'll be in your book. It says let the juices flow out, don't eat the skin and the fat. And you can reduce some of those toxicants. Mercury, on the other hand, is adherent in the flesh, so you cannot remove it. Now, as far as the fish oils that you eat and the pills, they've now had a way of distilling out all those kinds of things. So, and the type of fish chosen for the fish oil supplements are usually the small fish. It was PCBs that was the problem in the fish oil supplements, because those oily fish can have higher PCBs. So now what you want to do is you're going to take supplements, make sure it says third-party tested and it's been distilled, or it says mercury, PCB, lead, you know, arsenic-free.
Okay. Our thanks to Jane Hightower for her comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.